Well, thank you for staying for the duration. It's nice to see a good turnout right through the end of the day. I always take a lot of pleasure in introducing the final speaker. My friend Tom Quinn, who's probably been giving talks here just about as long as the center's been going. This afternoon, he'll tell us about something that he knows a bit about, migrations of salmon and trout in Puget Sound, new approaches to old questions. Tom?
Thank you, Pete. It's a great pleasure to see you, and in fact, to see you in the audience, any of you, much less all of you, and I really do appreciate people sticking around. I'd like to flatter myself that you're here for me, but I think you probably scoped out the wine bottles in the back and are hoping I can get through this quickly so you can get to the reception. Before I do, though, I want to make one other little introductory remark, and it's nice that the first talk of the day was on bull sharks, a fish, and we're ending with a talk on fish. I think, water center. Hey, how about that? You know, contrary to what you read in Genesis, God did not make water first. He created fish. He said, wow, how cool is that? What are we going to put them in? And then he created the water as a place to put the epitome of his creation. Anyway, I know it's late in the afternoon. You've sat through a lot of interesting and occasionally depressing material. So this is going to be relatively light on data, but mostly it's a shout out to some extremely exciting work that a number of people are doing. Some of them are my students. Some work for a variety of agencies and entities in Puget Sound. And I want to give credit to lots of these people. And in fact, in many ways, I'm really just the salesman here for the people that are doing all the real work. So here we have a couple of salmon. The overall question that this project is directed towards is how do different species of salmon and trout use Puget Sound as an environment. And fundamentally, we have this notion that salmon are produced in streams and they migrate out to the ocean after the smolt transformation period to grow big and fat and then come roaring back to spawn and die and make more salmon. So the question is Puget Sound simply a highway, a place that they have to get through between spawning and rearing grounds in freshwater and rich feeding grounds at sea, or is it a really important rearing habitat? And how does that vary among species? And echoing back to Aaron's talk at the beginning of the day, how does this vary among individual fish and use of different particular habitats, time of day, and so forth? So the conventional way of studying migrations of fish, and of course lots of other animals too, is to tag them or mark them in some way. And for a long time, there were studies by the International North Pacific Fisheries Commission and lots of other folks tagging immature and mature salmon at sea to find out where they came back, determine rates of travel, migration routes, and so forth. And so you have things like the Floy tags that are put in the clothes that you buy at Target or Nordstrom's or wherever that were put in things. Why is this not working? And we also have these disc tags that were attached to the sides of fish. Thousands and thousands and thousands of fish were marked in this way and yielded lots and lots of useful information. The second main program was to mark juvenile salmon in freshwater, typically in hatcheries, and recover them at some location in saltwater and connect the dots and infer something about their migration. And this was the Cotawire microtag developed in the late 1960s. It's a millimeter long, kind of rammed like a rebar into the skulls of little fish. You'd think it would kill them, but it doesn't. And a huge amount of information has been revealed by these techniques, and I don't want to denigrate them at all, but they do tend to be somewhat limited in the kinds of information that you can do since you just have a point of release and a point of capture. So in the 1960s, radio and ultrasonic tracking techniques were developed and popularized and started to get used by people working on fish and other kinds of animals. And these allow you to get more information because they give you repeated sources of information about the location of an individual animal. And they can be costly, they can be labor-intensive, they can be a huge headache. And so it's not a tool for all applications, but they do provide some useful information. And so fundamentally, you have a fish, a transmitter, either inserted into the stomach, surgically sewn into the body cavity, occasionally attached to the outside, beep, 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 and some kind of a receiver picking up the signal. And that's kind of the non-electronic version of how the system works. So I started doing this sort of thing in the 1980s and eventually conjured up what I call Project Rostamon, you know, not like Neon or Neptune or something like that, radio and sonic tracking applied to migration and navigation. Of course, those of you who listen to Bob Marley, you have reggae, Rostamon vibrations, transmitter, you're getting the image here. And this is a very loosely organized set of research projects. We're much too busy having fun to keep track of our contribution numbers and how many papers we've published, but I've had projects with students working on salmon and trout, freshwater, saltwater, different species, and together these are starting to gather some information on how fish move around. So the old way, when I started doing this, was you would catch a fish either in a trap or the purse seine vessel, put a transmitter in it, toss it over the side in salt water, and follow it from a boat until you were so exhausted, so sleep-deprived that you would eventually abandon it, and that was basically the end of the record. And we got a lot of good information, but the problem with that is if there's any kind of a handling stress associated with catching the fish and tagging it, you're just abandoning the fish right about when the data start getting representative. And also, it's very labor-intensive and costly to follow individual fish with a boat. More recently, a series of self-contained receiver hydrophones, look kind of like pipe bombs but aren't, were developed by a Canadian company called Vemco, and these can be batteried and deployed underwater, and they're simply out there listening, and if a fish with a transmitter swims by, beep, 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 it detects the identity code of the tag, date and time and so forth. They're recorded, and you download the data sometime later. So this is the acknowledgement slide, but really, in a way, this should be the whole talk. Again, I'm the front man here. I've been doing this work for quite a while, but the important people are all the folks here. A special shout out to Fred Getz, who's a doctoral student with me, although he also works for the Army Corps of Engineers. Josh Chamberlain is a master's student with me, also works for NOAA. A number of people in NOAA Fisheries are involved both as direct collaborators with me and also doing their own work, Barry, Skip, Anna, and so forth. A number of people with the different Puget Sound tribes and also the Northwest Indian Fish Commission are contributing to this effort. Seattle City Light, USGS, and there are many, many people tagging fish with their receivers, and there's a huge amount of data sharing and sorting that goes on. So our project is intermeshed within these, and there's kind of an organic movement of people doing this kind of work, and extensive collaboration and communication among the different people is really, really important. Again, a special shout out to Fred Getz, who is shown here beach seining for cutthroat around the locks. The exact number of receivers in Puget Sound varies because they're being deployed, retrieved, resurfaced, and so forth, but each one of those dots represents a receiver in the Puget Sound area. It's somewhere on the order of 200. So there's a huge amount of listening stations out there. Some are put out there by people who are interested in six-gill sharks, some English soles, some lingcod, some salmon. It's not as though there's one overall network that is top-down controlled. It's a series of investigators that are running their own projects, although there is also a Canadian project called POST, Pacific Ocean Shelf Tracking, which is much more top-down in organization. So the conventional wisdom that we have about some of the salmon and trout species is more or less as follows. The idea is that steelhead are relatively large as smolts when they leave freshwater. Typically after a couple of years, they're thought to migrate quite quickly through the coastal waters and out into the open ocean. Chinook and coho salmon are known to have populations that rear out in the coastal zone and the open ocean, but it's also been known to anglers and fishery managers that there are numbers of individuals of these species that are resident, in some sense of the word, within the inland waters of Puget Sound and the Strait of Georgia for all or some significant period of their marine life. And then we have a couple of species, notably cutthroat and bull trout, a char, that are believed to be resident, essentially obligate residents in Puget Sound and are thought not to leave very far from their natal stream. So we have a range of hypothesized migratory patterns among the different species of salmonids in Puget Sound. So what I'm going to do is step you through examples of each of these species. This is not going to be very, very data rich. Again, it's more or less to acquaint you with the kinds of data that we're collecting and the kinds of things that we're going to do with it. It'll sort of be science light, but I hope it'll stimulate some interest in the kind of work that we're doing. Steelhead smolts have been tagged in 06, 07, and 08. This is a species of great interest. Puget Sound population is listed as threatened under the ESA. Fish were tagged in four of the main rivers draining from the east side of Puget Sound, Skagit, Green, Puyallup and Nisqually. They include both hatchery and wild fish. Substantial numbers of fish have been tagged with the general goals to determine mortality, or more optimistically, survival rates, within rivers, in estuarine waters, as they move through the coastal zones, differences in migratory speed and survival between hatchery and wild fish, variation from year to year, use of habitats, and so forth. So just as an example, and these are some data provided by Sarah Hodgson with the Nisqually tribe, actually a former master's student of mine. Steelhead were tagged down in the Nisqually River. 91% of those that were tagged in the river were detected at the mouth or someplace farther along. A series of additional ones, 70% of the number that was tagged were still detected by Tacoma Narrows, 54% by West Point, and Admiralty Inlet and Juan de Fuca Strait. Now, these don't represent mortality rates per se, but they do indicate substantial loss during the movement through these areas. And there are obviously a variety of correction factors, but this is some of the kind of information that we're hoping to be able to get on a river-by-river basis and look at those survivals as a function of fish size, migration date, and a variety of those kind of biotic features. In addition, we kind of have an interesting situation in the Skagit River, because as fish are going down the Skagit River, when they get down to the estuary, there's the North and South Fork. And we're able to keep track of the proportion of fish going down the North and South Fork of the river. And that might actually just be contingent on what side of the river they happen to be migrating. Once they get out of the river, though, they can go through Deception Pass, which is a comparatively short route, or they can go down the south end of Whidbey Island, which is a substantially longer route. And then once they get through there, they have to make it out through Juan de Fuca Strait. So some of the kinds of analyses that we're hoping to do are to look at the contingencies among these different patterns. So, for example, are the fish that go down the North Fork of the river more likely to go out Deception Pass and the South Fork go around the long route? Do fish that go the long route eventually catch up and get out to Juan de Fuca Strait at the same time, or is there a significant delay? And is that delay associated with lower probability of making it out the sound? And you might have something as simple as what side of the river they happen to be sliding down that ends up having substantial effects on their migration rate and survival. Next species that we're doing some work on, Chinook salmon. Unlike the steelhead that are typically either tagged as smolts from hatcheries or caught in rivers, most of the Chinook are actually caught by purse seine vessel that's chartered in Puget Sound, although we have also been tagging some fish from hatcheries. So you get out there in a purse seine vessel, you bang out a set. Sometimes you catch fish, sometimes you don't. The usual vagaries of fishing. We have here Josh Chamberlain, graduate student, and Anna Cagley, a wonderful staff member at National Marine Fisheries Service Montlake Lab, anesthetizing and tagging the fish there. And so the MO here is a little bit different from the steelhead. So with these kind of data, because the receivers are being deployed and retrieved somewhat irregularly and you have a lot of time to get all the data back, I'm not going to present a lot of summary data, but just here's an interesting example. So here we have Bainbridge Island, one of the places we've done a lot of sets, here in Port Madison, just an example of one fish that was caught and tagged in November, 254, so that's like, what, about a 10-inch fish after spending about a summer in salt water. Well, that fish was detected heading out across a line of receivers at Juan de Fuca Strait on the 16th of November of that same year, chug, 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 and then March of that year was detected a little bit farther offshore coming back. It turns out that, and that is not necessarily that fish, but that's sort of more or less what that fish would have looked like, turned out that that fish was also detected by this Canadian line of receivers way down here. So tagged in Port Madison, out here, down, kicks around off the coast, and then comes zipping back there. So we start thinking about these things. You know, the traditional wisdom has been Chinook salmon go out to the coast and rear there and only come back as maturing adults, or they're resident, but it may turn out that resident and coastal migratory fish are really just two parts of a continuum of migratory patterns. We have some individuals that come back and forth repeatedly. There may be individuals that make regular or irregular loop migrations from Puget Sound up into Georgia Strait, a whole host of these things. And obviously, this is both interesting about the biology of the fish, but fishery management every time they cross jurisdictional boundaries, go into Canada and back, obviously complicates things. how often and how far do they move, and whether they show regular home ranges. In a number of cases, we'll see a fish that will hang around one particular place, for example, West Point, for several weeks, and all of a sudden will pick up and zip to the other side of the sound and be another place for several weeks, and then have a series of these locations that it moves among. And whether these are places that it becomes familiar with as an individual, or they're simply following concentrations of prey, are the sorts of things that we haven't sussed out yet. In addition to the position, though, as the receiver detects the presence of the fish, in some cases the transmitter also has a transducer that detects pressure, which of course is equivalent to depth, and so we can tell something about the depth of travel of individual fish. And we can consider issues of whether larger or smaller fish travel at different depths, those caught in different places, how does it change as they grow older, day, night, and so forth. So just a couple of examples of this. These are some data actually on maturing fish detected off West Point, and you have histograms of most of the fish from the top 10 meters of the water column down to about 70 or 80 meters. At an open waters of Puget Sound, they're actually swimming somewhat deeper than that because they were detected near shore. Most of the water isn't all that deep. So we can get that kind of information about the overall depth distribution. Here's an example of a kind of a running average of the diel depth distribution. So they're tending to be somewhat deeper in the dawn period, coming up a little bit closer to the surface during the day to midnight, and then dropping back down again. So we can start to tease apart some of these things. I see all the anglers starting to take notes here. How deep to deploy those trawlers. We're also studying cutthroat trout, and cutthroat trout are a very interesting fish. They're not as large as steelhead, and so they're not as avidly sought by anglers. They're not a commercial fish. They're kind of under the radar screen. Most of them in Puget Sound are wild, naturally produced fish. They're subject to only catch and release regulations in saltwater. There's very little fishery-type information on them, so they're among the least studied of the species, but a very interesting beast. This is one of my former students with one on the line at a secret undisclosed location. And there's no information published on their movements in the Puget Sound area. In fact, virtually nothing about their movements in saltwater at all. Depending on the population, they may spend from 6 to 9 or more months out of each year in saltwater. So in some ways, once they reach smolt stage, they're essentially a saltwater fish that briefly goes back to freshwater rather than a freshwater fish that briefly goes to sea. And so we're investigating this interesting beast. Most of the work is being done with fish from the Skagit River that are tagged at various stages in the lower reaches of that river. There's also some in central Puget Sound, quite a lot of fish caught in South Puget Sound, and these include fish that are caught as smolts leaving rivers and also that are caught by hook and line in a kind of a mixed stock area. And in particular, there's one site, Big Beef Creek, which is a research station of the University of Washington, where there's a smolt trap, and we've tagged quite a lot of fish leaving there. And I'll just show you some examples of some of the information we're getting on movements in Hood Canal. So this is one of the beasts. For those of you not familiar with them, we've tagged 30 or so fish, and most of these transmitters will last through the summer, so we'll get detections through the fall of the year. And there's been a series of receivers along both shores of Hood Canal, and also very kind of folks to put a bridge there because we're able to attach these receivers to the Hood Canal bridge, and so there's essentially no way for a fish to get out of Hood Canal without us detecting it going out and back, and that provides an indication of whether they really are resident within Hood Canal or migrating out and back routinely. So just sort of as an example, Big Beef Creek is here. There's a little kind of a pocket estuary and a bit of a causeway, so we've had a couple of receivers there. Virtually all the fish tagged are detected at one of those. The receivers are very, very good, but of course they're not without occasional gaps. And then you can see that quite a lot of detections down here, very few in the southern area, across around Hamahama River, up and in various spots. So these are the number of percent of detections by receivers. Well, that's not particularly interesting. Individual fish will move north and south. There's been a conventional wisdom among cutthroat fishermen that they never cross open water because they're typically caught very, very close to shore. In fact, you can sometimes see them in knee-deep or even ankle-deep water. But this is clearly incorrect. In a number of instances, they swim straight across Hood Canal. It may be that people simply don't catch them in open water. It's not because they don't go there. It's just either you can't catch them or nobody believes they're there, and so nobody fishes for them. And so the absence of information didn't indicate that the fish weren't there. And in some cases, moving fairly briskly, 19 kilometers a day, which is not sprinting, but that's a reasonable pace for a fish of that size, although they may also spend weeks in an area no more than 100 meters in circumference. So here's just sort of an example of one fish. And I know that this sort of research is sort of science by anecdote. I knew a really cool fish once that did this. But, you know, it's the late end of the afternoon. I figure that you'll tolerate that. So here he goes. This is the Hood Canal Bridge here for those that are kind of oriented. Heads on over there, July 13th. And comes down there on the 14th. Then is detected back up there on the 25th, and then things start to get interesting. Back down over there to the bridge, and then hip, hop, right across the bridge, and then back up there. So quite a lot of movement, including relatively direct swimming right across there by this particular individual. And again, as I say, you know, I knew a fish once that did this, but it's interesting to see these kinds of movements. And for those of us that are simply enthralled by the movements of fish, this is sort of as good as it gets. In addition, we start thinking about activity. So we've got these receivers. So I kind of envision that I'm a receiver, and any fish that is within, let's say, maybe 100 meters or so radius of my position will be detected. If I'm sitting out here listening, all of a sudden a fish is detected. Oh, beep, beep. That means the fish must have moved in order to have come into my sphere of detection. Then let's say that fish is around here for a day, and all of a sudden is no longer detected. Well, the fish was moving when he was in here, but he had to have moved again when he left. So when we sum up all these first and last detections, we can ask what time of day, what stage of the tide, the current, and so forth is associated with movement. So just as a couple examples, here are two fish, the numbers, of course, don't matter, that are more or less day active. You can see comparatively inactive during the hours of midnight to about 4 in the morning, start to become more active about 5. This is basically July and August and during the summer, fairly active then, and tail off. And you can say, well, kind of a weekly diel activity period with a daytime peak. Well, just to show that fish aren't all the same, there's one that I call Charlie Parker after the jazz man, clearly a night owl. This guy is essentially totally inactive during the day, doesn't really start to get going until it starts to hit dark, quite active during the night, and then shuts down. And this is not necessarily that individual fish, but just, again, giving you the idea. So we'll be starting to relate these individual differences to body size, date of migration, and so forth, but inevitably we'll be somewhat inadequate to completely plumb the complexities of behavior by these interesting fish. So by way of summary, these fish are more active and travel quite a bit more than we had expected, although essentially none of them actually left Hood Canal proper. So that part of the information was true. Move up and down, in some cases, quite a long distance in total, both north and south, crossing Hood Canal, although some individuals will stay in one localized location for weeks and weeks on end, then zip across Hood Canal and hang out someplace else for weeks and weeks on end. And there's lots of information on the timing of movement that we're still trying to tease apart. There are other kinds of fishes. This is one of my buddies fishing for coho salmon. They're a resident coho salmon. We've got transmitters in lots of them, and we're getting lots of information on these guys. I'm not going to specifically report it, but that's also a species with a substantial component of resident behavior. Is almost certainly is a natural behavior pattern, but is to some extent enhanced by hatchery practices. And so we're looking at the behavior of hatchery and wild fish, movement patterns, and so forth. For those of you that are astute, you'll notice that this is a sea louse here and has no adipose fins, so it's a hatchery fish, so I caught a lousy hatchery fish that day. Sort of by way of summary, again, this is Fred Getz, my grad student, Josh, and Anna here. The main message here is not the details, but the fact that there's a very large-scale, collaborative, and complicated project underway with many different entities, state, federal, tribal, lots of collaboration back and forth, trying to enhance our understanding of these species and the ways in which they use Puget Sound, shoreline, open water, estuaries, and so forth. The primary funding for my component of the project has been through NOAA Fisheries. I'm very, very grateful to them. Everybody who's helped. This is not a fish in Puget Sound, but it's kind of the idea here to close. I'll stop now. Thank you once again for sticking around to the end and take any questions if we have time. Thanks a lot. Yes?
Have you found much evidence with your most recent tag for American fish using Canadian water or vice versa, Canadian fish coming out of American water? How much cross-migration have you found?
The question was, to what extent have we found movement by Canadian fish to our waters and vice versa? The answer is slightly complicated because of a data sharing situation. Their receivers are maintained by a different system, and some of the slowest collaboration to get going has been exchange of information. I mean, the actual downloads of the files is almost like a Tower of Babel trying to get the information across the border. We do know that our fish do go across there. There's no question about that. We also know from Côte-d'Ivoire tagging and other forms of marking that there's a fair amount of back and forth. I think that that will be revealed as we get a lot of the data come back, particularly for the coho and Chinook salmon. I suspect the cutthroat and bull trout don't go up there much. The steelhead probably go pretty quickly out one to Fuca Strait, but the coho and Chinook, I'll bet, go back and forth. Yes?
There's some of you people here, let me tell you what Dr. Quinn and his predecessors have done. You give them lots of applause. The original fish hatcheries of the world were organized in this school. The original fish farm, Johnny Lindbergh, over Rich Passage, was organized in this school by Dr. Quinn, his predecessors, and by his associates. Tilapia were drawn into the United States of America through the University of Washington School of Fisheries, George Pigott and Dr. McMillan. Surimi, big crab, was put together in the University of Washington by Dr. Pigott and his associates. The Halibut Commission of the World was organized by this fellow's predecessors and some of his associates and St. Halibut. The Sockeye Run on the Fraser River and the Thompson River, or the Adams River, was put together with a fish ladder that was organized by this guy's predecessor, and you know it, as a fish ladder at Hiram Chittenden Moss. We owe Dr. Quinn, his predecessors, and his associates one hell of a plot.
Thanks for the kind words. I can't take credit for any of those things, but it was a nice thing to be said. Thank you. On behalf of my colleagues and former colleagues. Yes, sir?
I'm curious how you distinguish the fish that go by the transmitters from those that have become prey of either other fish or seals.
You know, that is an excellent question, and a lot of us spend a little bit of time worried about that one. One thing is, of course, most of those transmitters are going to be passed out by the predator. So if a seal eats it, those are normally passed, and people have done some of those kinds of studies. There are situations where there is evidence that some of that may be going on. More likely is that the fish either dies and just goes down there. In that case, the transmitter is just there and there and there and there and there until it runs out its battery life. Of course, if it goes back up a river, you know that it went back up the trap. Yeah, that's a complicating factor.
Tom, how do you recognize a fish that's carrying a transmitter?
Oh, well, we're only listening to the transmitter.
How would you?
Well, if you... if you fillet it, you'll find this strange-looking thing about this... If you were to catch one of these cutthroat trout, for example, and you saw some sutures in its belly, that might be a clue. I would hope you'd be handling them quickly enough and letting them go that you probably wouldn't notice. Those heal, so you wouldn't see it. It's not marked externally. And laboratory studies have been done, of course, to make sure that they recover, and all these sorts of things have been worked out. The size of the transmitter has to be a certain fraction of the size of the fish. So you probably wouldn't notice unless you were really looking. Yes, Dan.
The transmitting fish have a wire bar?
No, mostly not. Because, I mean, for example, if we purse seine up a Chinook salmon, it's just anesthetized, gets the transmitter, and back over the side. So we're not coated wire tagging them. In some cases, it might already be coated wire tagged. but we wouldn't be able to decode that when it was on the fish. We don't insert one. Yes?
I'm just curious, is it possible to tag these fish with GPS transmitters?
The short answer would be no, because of the depth at which they travel in the salt water. But with a sufficiently large number of receivers, we get a lot of detections. But part of the problem is you never have a receiver everywhere. And Puget Sound has a huge shoreline, and there are clearly places where the fish can go and not get detected, particularly in open water, because we tend to have more of the receivers along shorelines. Some of them get tagged, and we don't get much information about them. It's been said that if you like going outside in the rain, tearing up $100 bills, you'll love ultrasonic tracking. Maybe one more, Pete? One in the back?
One of your figures indicated that you have sensors deployed in freshwater locations. Could you describe the work for tracking movements in freshwater?
Some of the steelhead work, because they were tagged in hatcheries and at discrete freshwater locations, some of the purposes were to look at the migratory rate of hatchery and wild fish in the same river and proportion making it down to the estuary. So in those cases, there were receivers that were specifically deployed in freshwater during the smolt migration period for the steelhead. For the most part, other than that, they've been in saltwater. And those got pulled once the fish had moved out of that area and redeployed elsewhere. So for some of those fish, particularly the steelhead, we have migration rate down, for example, the Green River.
So the freshwater sensors are not being used for tracking Chinook movement?
No, for the most part, those are all in saltwater.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.